Hi, podcast listeners. Some great football over the weekend, wasn't it? I mean, I don't have a dog in the fight, but that was still some great football. We can all agree on that. We're going to talk today about the March for Life and have a firsthand account on today's show of the March for Life event in Washington, D.C., and we'll talk about pro-life issues more broadly. We will also dig into Russia's designs on Ukraine, and we will describe for you why it's important that we take the threat of Russian territorial aggression seriously. You'll enjoy today's program. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everybody. It's hour number two of Christian Worldview with Tony and Austin. Thanks for joining us for the program today. This is Tony Beam. I'm Senior Director of Church and Community Engagement for the Tim Brasher Campus of North Greenville University, where Christ makes the difference and where we are equipping transformational leaders for the church and society. I also serve as the Director of Public Affairs, along with my colleague, Lisa Van Riper, and I'm the Director of Public Policy for the South Carolina Baptist Convention. My co-host is Austin Barker.
Hi, everybody.
All right. It is very likely that Russia is going to invade the Ukraine. Now, the question is it going to be a full-on invasion? Are we talking take over the whole country? The British, according to British intelligence, came up over the weekend with this plot that Putin has to replace the Ukrainian government with a puppet that would be just an extension of Moscow and of Putin himself, and maybe that would be what happens, sort of a coup, a deposing of the government without full military intervention. But now that that's been unearthed, uncovered, it makes it more likely that you're going to see a full-on invasion of the Ukraine. And a lot of people in this country are pretty much shrugging about this.
See,
I mean, it's kind of a so what.
I think this is exposing a long-standing division, though, between hawks and doves on foreign policy. So I don't think there's anything new about the Ukraine thing. That it's just that we haven't had to talk about a situation like this. We haven't had a hostile takeover of a NATO or Western-friendly country that we've had to talk about like this. All the conflict has been in, you know, Somalia or places that are already ruled by totalitarians, and it's just an exchange of totalitarian regimes.
Right.
And so we haven't had to have this conversation for a while. I think it's interesting to see these arguments come up because it's kind of new to me. I haven't heard this since Kuwait.
Well, and when you look at you look at the timing of this, there is no question when it comes to geopolitical tensions that the Afghanistan debacle is the motivator for Putin to believe that he can get by with this. If the Ukraine is in NATO, this doesn't happen. If the Ukraine had been taken into NATO, and I get it, there's more involved. The Ukrainian government was corrupt. NATO was reluctant to take them on until they cleaned up their act.
Hey, we have standards.
They've been, well, and
I'm just saying that's their argument.
Right. NATO does. Mm-hmm. And they've been, you know, the Ukrainian government, to their credit, has been working on cleaning up their act. What I'm fascinated by are people like Tucker Carlson, who have a huge platform in the country, and his attitude. And Tucker Carlson's not the only one, but his attitude is that, you know, the Ukraine is something that Russia should be able to have. That we would, if we had a hostile, that NATO is encroaching in the Ukraine, and if we had hostility being projected toward us from Mexico or from Canada, that close to our border, an encroachment that of communism, then we would be just as concerned and would be taking some of the same action. So we should be supporting. I mean, Carlson actually said we should support Russia in their conquest of the Ukraine. Which just,
that's two clicks past ridiculous. Because if it's one thing to say that that we don't have an interest in Ukraine and we should keep our hands off, that's one thing. Okay,
right.
It's another thing to say that we should support Russia in taking over an independent country. That's
well, and here's to me some of the way to look at this and understand it. I think some of the best writing on this has been done by David French. Now he comes out and says explicitly, look, I'm not in favor of direct military intervention by the United States to protect the Ukraine.
Hmm.
And he said, that's just, I don't think that we can do that. We don't need to have an all-out shooting war with Russia over the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. But then he goes on to say that there are three reasons, as we look deeper, that we should be alarmed about Russian aggression. So in other words, let's say that it wasn't the Ukraine. Say it was Georgia. Say it was Poland. Say it was Czechoslovakia or Hungary.
You just push some buttons there.
Well, you know, I'm just saying, remove the Ukraine from the conversation,
yeah,
and think about the whole topic of Russian aggression. And here's what he says. First, history teaches us that Russia's desire to dominate the nations along its border extends when Russia's border extends. Even a glance at maps of either the immense Russian Empire of the 19th and 20th centuries or the Soviet Union at its height demonstrates that Russian interest, quote, and the Russian border have previously extended even to the west of Ukraine. Russia has in the past swallowed not just Ukraine, but also Belarus, the Baltic states, and Poland. And with each move west, its territorial insecurity has extended with it. Now, that's just true. That's an accurate reflection of history. There's nothing to suggest that once Putin has the Ukraine, that he's going to be satisfied any more than when Hitler took over the Rhineland, that was going to satisfy his desires for German expansion. I mean, I think Vladimir Putin wants a reconstitution of the Soviet Union. He was a hardliner. He's been a hardliner. Perestroika and Glasnost were things that Putin would not have approved of. He wants to return the Soviet Union to the glory days. Now, there are those who say that the Soviet Union, that Russia has degenerated into not much more than a gangster state, and that it is not the military power that it once was. I think that's absolutely true. But to say that Russia is not a military power that is going to have to be dealt with is also not true. I mean, you look at, they've got, 1,600, I think, last count, nuclear warheads that are spread out among land-based missiles, the Air Force, and their submarine fleet. So they have a nuclear capability that is daunting, and that shouldn't be ignored. So I think that
the takeaway is that we just need to take Russian aggression seriously.
Right.
This historical pattern. Let's just be realistic about what Russia is after, and that it's not going to stop with Ukraine.
Now look at what the president's talking about. What's happening? Well, we're moving ships into the area. Part of the U.S. fleet is going to a position that could be in the Black Sea that could be seen as a deterrent, or saying to Russia that we're preparing to respond in some manner. Now they're talking about, and I don't think the decision has been made, but Biden is considering, and this really shouldn't be in the news. This is the kind of stuff that needs to be talked about behind closed doors.
I agree with that. Because, if I could just interrupt you for one
sure.
second, the whole point is, regardless of what our ultimate strategy is on Ukraine, we shouldn't be telegraphing it.
Right.
You know, that's what Biden has shown that he's terrible at.
Right.
It's under this false canopy of transparency, which he's not good at it on its own merits, okay, but he wants to be transparent on issues like this, and so he just telegraphs his whole, everything that's in his head comes to his mouth. I'm sorry, when you're president, not everything that happens in your mind needs to come to your mouth. You got to hold your cards close to your chest sometimes.
Well, and what's being discussed is the deployment of tens of thousands total of U.S. troops to the Baltic states. In other words, to those states around in the area that may be threatened if the Ukraine is overrun. So the question becomes, because the Ukraine is not in NATO, what it looks to me like is there's sort of this consensus building that if Russia goes into the Ukraine, then they're going to get sanctioned. They're going to get crippling sanctions this time that could be very detrimental to Russia. And we'll talk about
The Russian politics of that, because Vladimir Putin has a very, very high interest in protecting his own popularity with the Russian people.
Right. And this, we'll talk about one of the sanctions in the next hour that could mean something to Russia. But it looks to me like what's being formed in NATO, by the way, is now beginning to deploy aircraft to these NATO countries where that may be threatened by Russian aggression once they get beyond the Ukraine. It's almost like, all right, you go into the Ukraine, you're going to have crippling sanctions. You take one step into a NATO country beyond the Ukraine, and we're gonna respond militarily.
Does that sound at all like if you use chemical weapons against your own people, though, we're going to draw a red line in the sand here? Does that, I mean, can you take that seriously?
I'm hoping that NATO is going to take it seriously, because this does become not just a United States matter, but a NATO matter if Russia goes beyond Ukraine.
And again, I just have to ask the question. The United States has always been the front runner in terms of, you know, pushing back against expansionism globally.
Right.
Do you really think that France is going to take that role when the U.S. won't?
Well, France, in this case... We're seeing movement of NATO assets into areas that could be affected once Putin moves into Ukraine. So that's encouraging, but it's not. It doesn't mean that they won't pull back. It doesn't mean, you know, you've got to be willing to use those assets. It's one thing to have F-15s and F-16s and F-whatevers in a location that would allow them to go to war. If that was necessary, it's another to throw the switch and consider that you're in an open fighting war with Russia over the former Soviet states that are now part of NATO.
Bombs away.
I mean, it really is it's a very tense time. And you've got China sitting over there. You know, I think China has long wanted, obviously, Taiwan and the Philippines and eventually Japan. There's just communist expansion is always on the move when weakness is perceived by the West.
Right.
And that's exactly what Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin see in the West right now.
That's right.
The United States is a weak leader, and certainly Germany's not going to step up to the forefront. France is not going to. Great Britain is not going to. The United States has to lead. These countries will come along if the United States aggressively and with clear policy in mind takes the lead.
But again, this has long roots. And America's isolationism, or America's romance with isolationism, has very, very long roots, clear back into the pre-World War I days. And so we're divided by oceans. And so that has a real impact on the American psyche.
Woodrow Wilson got reelected after campaigning on the fact that he kept us out of World War I. And by 1917, we were sending tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands of troops to Europe to fight in the closing stages of World War I. Same thing in World War II. We wanted to stay out of World War II. We were not able to stay out of World War II.
Because our oceans no longer protected us. And that was evidenced on December 7th. And so that was the impulse to get, you know, September 11th. And then all of a sudden you find American troops on foreign soil. Because whenever you hit America across our oceans, then that wakes us up. But we can just slumber over here between two oceans. And it really is a psyche thing, this isolationism.
All right, let me quickly say this before we go back to this discussion about Russian aggression and why we should be concerned about it. First of all, Mitch Prosser, who is outreach director for the Palmetto family, and has been doing an incredible job, was at the March for Life this weekend. And so he's going to call us at 8:45 this morning. We're going to kind of wrap up a little conversation with him about what happened, what was on the ground going on in Washington over the weekend. But I want to say something about people that talk about the military-industrial complex and the war hawks and the, you know, this is drum beating toward war for nefarious purposes. I have absolutely no regard for that kind of thinking. And the reason is because that kind of thinking would have turned Europe over to Adolf Hitler. And almost, well, it did. I mean, it did. How many people had to die? How many people would be alive today, or, well, not today, but who have lived for a generation, if Hitler had been stopped after he went into Poland? What if the world woke up and said, you know what, this guy—
Munich never happened.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
What if this guy, I mean, if we realize this guy's going to take over the entire world, he's going to invade France, he's going to bomb the soup out of Great Britain, he's going to take over all of Europe. He wants to establish the Third Reich for 1,000 years. What if we took him seriously and stopped him in his tracks instead of, well, no, you know, we don't want to go to war. We don't want peace at any cost. The Neville Chamberlain crowd. Look, war's serious business, but there's evil in this world that will not listen to or be stopped by any other means. Vladimir Putin, when he came to the table to negotiate, his negotiating points were so outrageous and so ridiculous. Now, this is according to the Washington Post, that it was that experts on Russian behavior believe that he never intended for there to be
That's
anything.
That's exactly right.
He was just stalling to get his ducks in a row and seeing how far he could push the West. He knew that there was no way that the West was going to agree, that NATO was going to be reduced, that NATO was never going to be allowed to expand, on and on, that Russia was going to be granted access to the Ukraine. It was not a legitimate negotiating point, any of it. And Putin is a dictator. He rules by the force of power. And people who ignore that and think that the United States can sit back and allow Europe to collapse into another war where Russia is marching through and reclaiming former Soviet territory, particularly when we're talking about our alliances with these countries, the commitments that we've made. If our word means nothing, which already a lot of the world thinks it means nothing, if it really does mean nothing, then we're going to see chaos in Europe that will spread to the United States. You can't be an isolationist. The United States is the leader of the free world, and either we exercise that leadership responsibly or we allow evil to go unchecked and dictators to start rampaging, and don't expect the rest of the world to stand up to the bullies. I mean, all right, let me get back here quick to David French's point. History teaches us Russia's desire to dominate the nations along its border extends when Russia's border extends. That's number one. Number two, the reintroduction of great power territorial aggression would once again destabilize the world order. In other words, you've got the same thing that was happening in Germany prior to World War II and in Japan. Great power, the expansion of great power, and that great power becomes aggressive. It doesn't contain itself, but decides that it's time to ignore the desires of other nations and just simply exercise our military power because we've got it to throw around. If you don't stop that kind of aggression, then it's going to destabilize the world and move us closer to armed conflict that we're not ready for, I don't think, in the United States. The third thing, what starts in Europe rarely stays in Europe. You know this is true. Dating back to shortly after the founding of the nation, the United States has encountered the same pattern. Europe goes to war, we seek to remain at peace, yet ultimately we find ourselves in the fight. You know that it's largely forgotten that our War of 1812 was a footnote to the Napoleonic Wars, a fight started in part because of British-imposed restrictions on American trade, which was designed to block trade with Napoleon's France and British impressment of American sailors so that the Royal Navy would have enough sailors to fight France. I mean, this was about a European conflict that spread to the United States. That's the same thing that happened in World War I. We've already talked about that. And the same thing that happened in World War II. When you have an expansionist power led by a dictator who has no self-restraint but has designs on a large portion of that part of the country, the more he is unchecked, the more he's going to continue to expand. You know, in 91, George H.W. Bush knew that Saddam Hussein had to be thrown out of Kuwait because he would not stop with Kuwait. In fact, when you had the Saudis and Jordan and Egypt all saying, you know, we can buy this guy off. Let's let him have Kuwait. What's the big deal? Well, the big deal was that with Kuwait, Iraq would control 25% of the world's oil reserves. Because if you look at the time, Saudi Arabia was number one in the world with oil reserves, then Iraq, then Kuwait. And if Saddam Hussein controlled Kuwait, he was already beginning to move his forces toward the border with Saudi Arabia. Because at the time, the Saudis had a pretty strong air force, but they didn't have a ground force that could match Saddam Hussein, who had the fourth largest army in the world. There's no question, if the line hadn't been literally drawn in the sand, and Saddam Hussein thrown out of Kuwait, and it demonstrated that the rest of the world would not abide an expansionist dictator who wanted power for the sake of power, then there's no question that Saddam Hussein would have gone into Saudi Arabia and that war would have expanded to all of Europe.
And what made the calculation way easier, Tony, and I don't expect you to disagree with this, some people would, is that America did have a financial interest in
sure.
Kuwait. You know, we have
sure.
we had a very strong oil connection to Kuwait, and so did the rest of Western Europe. Like Kuwait
right.
is the source of a lot of the oil for the rest of the world at that point. And so it was an easier calculation for us to make than to go into Ukraine, where there's not necessarily such a strong economic tie.
Absolutely true. The threat to the West is not necessarily Russia taking over the Ukraine. The threat to the West is that that's not where Vladimir Putin will stop. NATO allies will be threatened. And if we don't keep our alliances and our treaties, what has held the world away from world war since World War II will be broken. I mean, it's been the combined military, the threat of the combined military strength of the West. The United States is the leader, but also Great Britain, France, the Germany, the countries that have basically said, we're going to protect the peace. We're not going to allow bullies to go unchecked. We're not going to have another World War II. If that align, that's what NATO was all about. It was to prevent another worldwide conflict. If those alliances fail, then we're going to have another worldwide conflict.
If I'm not incorrect, NATO was not necessarily formed so much to prevent worldwide conflict as it was to prevent communist expansion. And
well,
so it was basically a Western alliance to check the growth of the East.
Well, it was, but it was also another big part of the goal was to make sure that after World War II, that there was not another opportunity for a power-mad dictator to engulf the world in war. In other words, these countries would stand together to prevent that from happening.
And to me, I think that by either one of those measurements, I mean, if you're trying to prevent the world from descending into chaos, that's the UN to me. They're the ones that's kind of trying to hold the world together. But NATO, if you say your goal is to prevent Russian expansion or communist expansion, and then you have an opportunity to stand your ground whenever Russia is demonstrating
right.
clear,
right.
you know, expansionist instinct,
well,
and you don't?
And if the word of the United States becomes null and void, I mean, we already are suspect to the rest of the world.
That's right.
Because of this disaster in Afghanistan. And we did make a commitment to the Ukrainians, if they gave up nuclear weapons in the 1990s, that the United States would stand by them to protect them from Russian aggression. And what are we doing? You know, it's and again, let's go back to when Barack Obama was president. If the Obama administration had been more aggressive in their response to protecting Ukraine when Russia decided to take over Crimea.
Mm-hmm.
If the line had been drawn there, we wouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm.
It just depends on where and when you want to draw the line. And the longer you let a dictator, like Vladimir Putin grow in power and absorb countries around him, the more lives it will take, the more resources, and the longer and more protracted that fight will be to put him back in his box.
Yeah, that's well said. Just think of it as a 100-car train, and the faster that train gets moving, the more it's going to take to stop that thing.
Right. Okay, a question about sanctions. One of the things Austin wrote a question here for me on one of his sticky notes is, will sanctions work?
Because it sounds like an idle threat coming from Biden. We're gonna smack you on the hand if you take over Ukraine. Bad dog down.
Yeah, but there are things that have never been brought to bear that the world has to agree on that basically crushed Iran and brought them to the negotiating table. The problem is, when Iran came to the negotiating table because of crushing sanctions that were destroying their state, President Obama was in office, and the deal we got was a stinker. I mean, we could have had a deal that would actually have put Iran in a box when it comes to their nuclear capability, but instead we gave them a roadmap to become a nuclear power. It was insane, and it came at the point that real sanctions were making a difference. So this is, let me just read a little bit of this from National Review today. And this is from an article by Kevin Williamson. The title is "The Well-Armed Troll," talking about Vladimir Putin. So when it comes to sanctions, American political leaders in both parties have focused a great deal of attention on the Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline connecting Russian producers with German consumers, opposition to which just happens to accord with the business interest of the U.S. energy producers. But if Washington is looking to lean on Moscow, then the American eye should travel southwest from Berlin to Brussels. In other words, now what they're talking about here is that the Nord Stream connection, that natural gas pipeline, if to cut that off is going to hurt Germany, it's not going to, I mean, it would hurt the Russians, but it would also hurt the Germans. The Germans should never have made this deal. You know, the Trump administration tried to keep Germany from making a deal for this natural gas pipeline that Germany allowed Russia to build in Germany. So that's probably not going to work as a sanction. But if you go to Brussels, which is the corporate home of the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, the acronym is SWIFT, the financial messaging system that makes a great deal of modern banking possible. While states such as Russia and Cuba have shown themselves willing and able to endure conventional financial sanctions, cutting a nation out of the SWIFT system is a different thing altogether. Without access to SWIFT, Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, a country's businesses cannot pay for imports or get paid for exports in the conventional way. So in other words, you get Russia out of this organization, you sanction them so that they can't use SWIFT, then it's going to be impossible for them to find a way to export or import. And if that happens to Russia because of the lack of natural resources they have, that's a death sentence. I mean, that is a sanction that has real teeth that could put the Russians, I mean, it could put a lot of pressure on Putin.
So, and that's why I said that the political pressure at home for Putin is what really matters, okay? Because that's right. The only thing that's really going to make him stand down. I wonder if, what I've observed, Tony, from totalitarian rulers around the world is that they don't care about the welfare of their people. They care about their own political power.
Right.
And so as long as they are able to protect their own political power, it doesn't matter what's happening to the people. The only reason they care about what's happening to their people is because if the people get too uncomfortable, then eventually they'll revolt and overthrow their political power. But that's still, they only care about their political power.
When you go back to Iran and you look at, you know, what happened that, again, brought them to the table for a bad deal negotiated by the Obama administration. Of course, Joe Biden was part of that deal.
He was.
Which doesn't give me a whole lot of confidence
in this
current
day. He had
day.
Opinions that were wrong. If he didn't have any clout in it, he had the wrong opinions.
National Review writes, Iran weathered other U.S. sanctions, but when its access to SWIFT was interrupted, its oil exports collapsed, and Tehran came to the negotiating table. So they couldn't export the oil that pays for everything that the Iranian government does because they were banned from SWIFT. Now, the problem is that was a big stick for the United States in 2012, but now, by SWIFT's own account, it is complying with European regulations enforcing European Union sanctions. That's what they were doing with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
The United States was not the driver.
Mm-hmm.
You had to get the European Union to go along with that.
Mm-hmm.
So now SWIFT describes itself as neutral, but it's incorporated under Belgian law and has to comply with the regulations as confirmed by its home country government. So to get SWIFT to exclude the Russians and to make that sanction have teeth, the United States is going to have to form an alliance with the European Union that they're going to have to go along with that in order to put meaningful sanctions against Russia. And we just don't know if they're going to do it or not.
So can I ask a question? This is kind of an oddball
sure.
one, but it comes out of right field this time. What would Donald Trump do right now?
I don't know, because if you look at Trump's record when it comes to issues like this, when there have been flashpoints, he was quick to say, I'm going to use American power, military power, but then he backed up. So and looked at it from a different way. Trump didn't start a war. I mean, he was it would be interesting to see what Trump would do. I think he would probably put pressure on the European Union to use SWIFT as a tool against the Russians, because that's probably the only thing that's going to get their attention. I mean, we've sanctioned the Russian economy before, and it really hasn't had any effect on what Putin decides to do. In fact, he's used it as an excuse to take aggressive action to maintain the props that he has with the Russian people. You know, look, this is the West coming after us unfairly. I'm going to project Russian power over the West, that kind of thing. But this would cripple what's left of the Russian economy. Russian economy's in shambles as it is.
What would Lindsey Graham do?
I have no idea. I all I can say is we're going to have to be content with what President Biden decides to do. We don't have to be content with it, but you know, it. Hopefully he can get the European Union. Right now he's got NATO. There's an agreement obviously been struck that the United States, at least we're considering sending troops to protect NATO
countries. We've already
sent
two shipments of weapons to Ukraine, so that's
right,
something.
Right.
And Biden's mouthing out loud, we could do more.
We're moving our naval power in proximity to take action if it's necessary. But I think the action, I really believe that what's happening is a coalescence around current NATO members to protect them as opposed to stopping Putin from going into the Ukraine.
I think I could live with that.
So, all right. Before we go to Mitch Prosser, let me just say that NATO's response so far in moving fighters and assets to the region has been, shall we say, muted. We need to make that point. Denmark is sailing a frigate to the Baltic Sea and sending four F-16 fighter jets to Lithuania. Denmark is not exactly a military powerhouse. Spain is sending ships to join NATO naval forces in the region. That's a good thing. It's considering sending fighter jets to Bulgaria. France is sending troops to Romania, and the Netherlands also said it will send two, mind you, F-35 fighter aircraft to Bulgaria in April. I mean, if that's it, I'm sure Vladimir Putin's not shaking in his blue suede shoes. He's got armored divisions and 100,000 troops ready to move in to overwhelm the Ukraine. And there's a couple of fighter jets going to be sitting in Bulgaria and a couple of ships going into the Baltic Sea.
Well, see, but that was one of my questions. Will putting troops in Russia's way work or to deter them?
Well,
if we put American troops on the border of Ukraine and Russia and Putin had to steamroll those and kill Americans to get to Ukraine.
No, that would be different.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, would that work? Would that motivate the Americans to realize?
This is to get his attention.
Yeah.
This is not going to deter, but if NATO begins to demonstrate that they're willing to begin to move assets into the region, then with hopefully behind the scenes, there are discussions going on that says this is only the beginning.
Yeah.
We're going to keep these assets flowing if you continue to make aggressive moves.
And that's an escalation argument, and that is scary to people. I don't care what your opinion on the topic is. Escalation is scary.
It's scary. I mean, all-out war with Russia right now, I don't know that we're ready.
But if 14 people die, you know, in some sort of air quotes accidental conflagration over there, is that going to motivate the West to say, you know, this is what Russia is, this is what it's about, this is the score?
I don't know. This weekend, the March for Life in Washington took place. Mitch Prosser was there. Mitch, thanks for calling.
Hey, Tony and Austin, good morning. How are y'all?
Good morning. We're doing well. Appreciate you and all the great work you do with Palmetto Family. I just wanted to get your perspective on what the March for Life was like in Washington. We're hearing that there was a lot of optimism being expressed because of Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health. Is that what you saw and heard while you were there?
Absolutely. I'll tell you, what an incredible opportunity for people from all around the world to come and show their support for life. I tell you, we witnessed some incredible things. And when I mean around the world, I literally mean at almost all, we noticed almost every state and several other countries, U.S. protectorates involved, groups from American Samoa, Poland, places that we would never think would have pro-life contingencies like Washington State or Massachusetts or even Northern Virginia. I'll tell you, what was incredible was to see, and it's hard to get a good read on this, but the massive amount of people under the age of 25, I'm going to say it was around 75%, three-quarters of the people out there for the March for Life this past weekend were under 25. It was just awesome to see the youth movement in the most pro-life generation since Roe was decided in 73. It was incredible to see so many people out there in spite of the nice, balmy 18-degree weather that we experienced.
Yeah, what about the speakers, Mitch? Who are some high-profile people that talk to the crowd that our listeners would recognize?
So we had the opportunity to meet and hear from Abby Johnson and Tim Tebow on Thursday night at a dinner.
Right.
But on Friday morning, we heard from Kirk Cameron. We heard from singer and songwriter Matthew West.
Right.
And several others that would be considered high profile when it comes to speaking out for life.
Now, you went to the march on Saturday, right? Or did you come back before that?
We were at the march on Friday.
On Friday. Okay, I'm sorry. Friday, right. All right. What speaker do you think generated the most response from the main stage on Friday?
Kirk Cameron was phenomenal.
Okay.
Did an outstanding job telling his story, the story of his family, his wife, how if she had been aborted because they encouraged her mother to abort her, that his children wouldn't be there. He would have never met her, and the trajectory of his entire life would have changed with that choice that her mom made. So what an incredible story that from him. And the crowd was electric, no doubt about that.
Let me ask you, did you hear much response? We talked a little bit about today. There was some being written about the fact that a pro-choice Catholic group were projecting pro-abortion messages on the Catholic Basilica in Washington while Catholics inside were praying and rallying against abortion. Was there much talk about that? There's been a good bit in the media about it.
Well, you know how the media loves to cover those offbeat subjects and project it as if they were the mainstream.
Right.
There was very little, absolutely very little, pro-abortion rhetoric. There were very few. pro-abortion groups lining the march.
Right.
There were some up on Capitol Hill near the Supreme Court, but if you could compare the two groups, they were probably outnumbered 1,000 to 1. When I say this, it's hard to get a good read on how many people were there for the pro-life march.
Right.
But I'll say this, it was in the hundreds of thousands.
Right. Well, and that's the way it is every year. There are always protest groups. Sometimes their numbers are larger, but we've been hearing other reports saying that there were fewer protesters this time for whatever reason. I don't know if COVID, the threat of Omicron had something to do with that or whatever, but much, much more of a loud pro-life voice without the protesters involved. You know, the Biden administration put out a statement, both Kamala Harris and President Biden, or it could be President Harris and Joe Biden. I can't always get that confused because the president does. But anyway, they put out a statement saying, you know, reiterating their 100% commitment to killing babies. I mean, I find that they talked about that Roe is under attack. And what a different environment coming from Washington, from the leadership, than what we've had in past years with the leadership that we got from President Trump, who was most decidedly pro-life.
Absolutely. Well, and not to go on the attack, but just to point out the obvious, I find it profoundly remarkable how hypocritical the president has been on this historically.
Right.
He is a Roman Catholic and considers himself a practicing Roman Catholic.
Right.
And the hypocritical mark of this is that his faith declares that life is cherished in the womb. And yet he is supporting Roe. This past year we heard him call for an end to case there which would prohibit federal funding for abortions in that amendment, the Hyde Amendment. So it's amazing to me how out of one side of his and others' mouths, like Nancy Pelosi, they speak this, well, we are Catholic by faith, and yet in the very same breath, they talk about how it's a woman's choice or women's health or they have a right to this. Listen,
right.
Whatever happened to the choice of the baby in the womb
Certainly.
And their rights as humans and as if born here, U.S. citizens.
Yeah.
So it's just remarkable how hypocritical some of our leaders have been on this issue.
Well, I think it'd be safe to say that President Biden and Nancy Pelosi and other high-profile Catholics that are practicing the Catholic faith need a lot more practice when it comes particularly to pro-life issues. Mitch, thanks for taking the time to be with us this morning. I'm looking forward to seeing you some. Obviously, we'll see each other in Columbia this week. A lot going on. A hearing on Wednesday morning that we'll talk more about tomorrow morning on the program in medical affairs on 2 pro-life bills. So a lot happening, and we'll be talking more about it. God bless you, brother. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, sir. Thanks. God bless you guys.
Okay, Mitch Prosser from Palmetto Family. Appreciate his work and contribution there. That's all the time we've got for today, but we'll be back in the morning at 7 a.m. with more Christian Worldview with Tony and Austin. Don't forget to check out the podcast.